Newsflux, season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast, coming at you via our new YouTube channel. Come here, mama, and dig this crazy scene. We're not too fancy, but our line is pretty clean. We ain't no drag, YouTube. Papa's got a brand new bag.
Nice.
What do you think of that, Avalone?
I think that's good. I was going to go with it's my happening and it's freaking me out.
Okay. Well, yeah. Do you, man? Do you? I am Rylan Grant. I am a screenwriter. I am the Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, The Jump, and most recently The Breach. The other voice in the dark, the beautiful man in the box to my left on your YouTube screen is
David Avalone, writer of comics and things, Batwheels for TV. Drawing Blood and all sorts of Elvira comics for comics. Oh, and yeah. Coming in 2025, Two-Fisted Fairy Tales.
Love it. I'm looking forward to that. Subscribed. And so we've been doing this show for a while. This is episode 100 and something. We've had a lot of amazing conversations previously. Episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes. And some great conversations with the guests we're going to have on today. You should double on back and check all that out. You can find it all on Apple Pods. You can find it wherever you get your ear crack. But in the coming months, you are going to see it sort of matriculate very carefully and very expertly over to this YouTube channel. You'll get to see our pretty faces, the prettier faces of our guests. So this is the place to come now. We're gonna do some other stuff here. We're gonna have some short form content. We're gonna have some one-on-one conversations with creators, fireside chat sort of things. There is talk of Avalone, you maybe bringing Pulp Today onto the channel.
We're gonna see.
You tell us what you want to see. We'll try and give it to you. And yeah, we're trying to create a kind of a community center here. This is a place where creators can gather and talk shop and ask questions of each other, and demand the best of one another. So I don't know, maybe that's a high bar to clear, but I'm ready to get the old pole out and try and vault over this shit. So there we go.
Like
we should get our guests on soon, but you have something to promote before we get the ball rolling?
I think I can't actually remember if it's January or February. I have Savage Tales coming out, which is cool. Got three stories by me and one by Kurt Busiek, which is nice. And then later in the year will be Two-Fisted Fairy Tales and Drawing Blood 7 through 12 is still coming.
So, gotta love it.
From Image.
Gotta love it. Yeah.
And you?
My films of State of Consciousness and with Emil Hirsch and Haunted Heart with Academy Award winning director Fernando Treba and Matt Dillon. Those are all available on your streaming devices. So, you know, check that out. The fourth issue of The Jump will be dropping first quarter next year, probably early February on Kickstarter. So do that. But Homeboy is incorporated now. Comic company announcements coming. Got some properties I'm nailing down. There's going to be a lot more comic content from old Ryland. It's going to blow your doors off. So look for it. Watch this channel, watch the social media. A lot of great new announcements coming very soon. So let's shut up. Let's bring the cool people in and get out of the way.
Please welcome Barbara Dillon.
Hey everybody, good to be back.
Richard Ferrey.
Oh yeah, keep that clap going.
And Charlie Stickney.
Hey,
all applause for the kids. Yeah, when we were talking about doing a sort of relaunch of the video content side of the writer's block, we discussed doing a sort of writer's block all stars video, and you're it. I think definitely the most appearances and great contributors to what we've been doing since 2020. What was it,
and
May?
Apparently,
2020?
The most photogenic for YouTube, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We got, yeah, we, we got the prettiest people together. That was what I pushed for. Avalone's like, let's get the smartest and all that. And we did do that also, but we also, I'm like, they need to be pretty. That's what we're at.
Very nice. And there's my plane has shown up.
Ooh,
So thanks for coming on. I think, you know, having you guys here particularly and positioning it as a relaunch of sorts for us, it might be a good time to tune in and go like, what's going on and where do you think we sit in the state of things right now? I'll let Charlie start with that.
Do you mean the state of the world?
No. Let's not talk.
That's a very different interesting than the state of.
Let's not talk about the slow rolling.
Who did you? Yeah. Who did you vote for, Charlie, and why?
And where do I live? We'll go into all of those.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. If you could just put your phone number up there. State of the comic scene, right? Go ahead, Avalon. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say with 2020, we're all sort of making our plans for 2025 and. What are you going to do the same? What are you going to do differently? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think one thing that we're going to see is we're going to continue to see a bit of a transition in terms of how the industry is being run. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to be a very hard time for smaller publishers in the direct market. And I think it's going to be a harder time for creators who don't have big audiences to also go into the direct market. I think it's going to be a harder time for creators who don't have a big audience to be on Kickstarter. In general, I think there's a little bit of a regression going on in the comic industry and is trying to figure out where the new balance is going to be. And until that happens, a lot of retailers, a lot of consumers seem to be going back to what you'd call like the blue chip brands. So in the direct market, that's the IP that you know, or the creators that you know well. On Kickstarter, it's the same thing. And I think as a creator, you have to be cognizant that that's happening, and really be honest with yourself. Where is your place in the industry? And I don't mean like, you know, put yourself down, but see how people perceive you, what kind of audience that you have. And you know, what can you do to combat that? And what I'm seeing right now that's happening is there's a lot of bundling of brands, smaller brands to create bigger brands. And I think we're going to see more of that going forward, both in the crowdfunding space, in the direct market with imprints like Ghost Planet. You know, like there's people coming together to unify to create a larger brand, which will have more, hopefully, more marketing power and brand presence.
By that, are you talking about smaller comic companies working together? I mean, literally, I just read, a friend of mine did a cover on Creepshow and gave me a copy to read. And that was Image and Skybound. And it's also IP. Those things need each other, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and the other big thing, and we can get into this more, I mean, that there's been some articles recently about Diamond and how Diamond's lost yet another exclusive contract. So at this point, Dynamite is their only big publisher that they have an exclusive contract with. And I think ultimately that's going to hurt the smaller publishers, because if Diamond goes under, there's going to be no distribution mechanism in place to help the smaller publishers get to those markets. So it's a dangerous time. It's a tenuous time. And I think we just all need to be aware of what's happening and figure out the ways to do best what we do.
And have the smaller companies all gone to Lunar?
No. So Lunar has cut off bringing in new publishers. That's the thing. Lunar realizes that there's a bandwidth, and Diamond was taking anybody. And that's part of the problem, is when you have a lot of little things that don't bring you back a lot of return, they still cost a lot of manpower to be able to process, to bundle, to send out. So Lunar's only doing the bigger publishers. They only have so much warehouse space, and they're like, we're done until things stabilize, and they haven't figured it out. So, you know, a lot of retailers are like, well, I wish you were with Lunar. I wish you were with Penguin Random House. But if you're Flying Monkey Press, and because I don't want to use anybody's real names, they're not going to take you.
Right.
But they're not going to take you. And that's where you're seeing a lot of, like, the musical chairs have kind of stopped and there's no more seats. So if you're not with Diamond, there doesn't seem to be another option right now.
Interesting. Richard, what's your take?
I think Charlie's right, and he knows how hard it is for me to say that. But, you know, I have been...
You almost got a Charlie spit take, which is, you know, traditional for the show. This spit take as an expression of agreement. Sorry, go on.
And those are never staged, right?
No, never. It's always... I'm surprised every single time Ryland yells, I'm surprised.
That's pretty good.
That's amazing. My first four appearances, I forgot that he yelled at the beginning. I think Charlie's right. I think I am one of the creators that he's talking about, not specifically, but like I have a very dedicated audience, but they are small. And I think it's going to be a lot harder as money gets tighter and as, you know, tariffs and things come in to fuck us all. It's going to be rough. I'm certainly taking a lot. I've been turning down a lot of jobs over the past few years, and I have said yes to a lot of jobs in the past 2 months. Fortunately for me, jobs that I will happily have, but I'm writing for other companies now, which I haven't done for a couple of years, and I am accepting invitations to pitch certain things to certain places. I have had without throwing any company under the bus, I had a tentative offer on the table on November 3rd. And on November 6th, I was casually informed that they were going to rescind that because they were not going to move forward with this because they couldn't be certain that books by someone like me would be welcomed into mainstream stores within the year, which sucks. But well,
a lot of complying in advance going out there and going on out there in spite of everyone saying, oh no, don't comply in advance.
If anyone has like a spare six figures they could send me to make up that shortfall, I would love it. Otherwise you can find me writing pornography for various companies.
and one recession-proof industry.
Yeah,
I mean, we all gotta jerk it sometimes, you know.
It's the best Richard anyway, so we'll take him.
I am also like my plan is not being influenced by this. This is not compliance in advance, but I sort of announced through my book Ambitious Failures about 4 months ago that I am definitely relaunching Blastosaurus. I just have decided that. I realized that I created it when I was a teenager. I launched the book in my 20s. It was relaunched in my 30s. So I have to wait till I turn 40 to put out the first issue of the new relaunch. So that'll be sometime next year. So, you know, dinosaurs, safe money.
Yeah. Very, very, very safe. Everybody loves a dinosaur. It's funny. I never made this connection before, but it makes me think of Ben Edlund and The Tick. Like, he's done The Tick five different times and four of them as a TV show, and each iteration is significantly different but great and appropriate to the time in which it's made.
Yeah.
You know, during the Seinfeld Friends era, he made a goofy sitcom. You know, during the aughts, he made a great comedy drama about trauma that was about a guy in a big blue tick costume. You know, and I think there's a similar thing with you and Blastosaurus, that Blastosaurus will always come around again in a format that is who you are right now when you're doing it. You know,
what's also nice, and like, not to dominate everything here, but I started that thing when I was a teenager, and I was very much under the thumb of someone who had me convinced that I needed a co-writer who didn't really contribute anything. And I've actually never done Blasto entirely on my own, and this will be the first time doing it where there are no compromises to what I want this thing to be. There's always been
great
companies who have swooped in and said like, "Hey, this could be this thing. Can you just make it a little bit more in line with?" Everyone sees it and says this should be a TV show. Can you make the comic look like a TV show? And I stupidly, when I was young, said yes. And there's never been a comic. There's never been a TV show made from a comic where they. Where it looked like the comic book. Like, that's what adaptation is. So mm-hmm. it is now a story about a retired crime-fighting dinosaur who does whatever the fuck I want him to do.
Sure.
It's going to be great.
Well, that's great. And I definitely am looking forward to see that. Barbara, what's your take?
I will also concur with everything that Charlie said. And I feel like I've been having a lot of conversations with folks in the library space. We never really pushed hard into the direct market. We did push more into the library space. And for independent publishers and creators, it has always been a challenge. There have always been barriers to get into that space, but it is getting increasingly harder. I feel like there's a civil war brewing amongst the library community right now for obvious reasons of our political climate. Funding is getting harder and harder. Librarians and educators are truly on the front lines of censorship challenges, book bans, etc. They're being pushed to limits that no one should have to do in their job, just being asked to do things that are far outside the boundaries. And for independent creators and publishers, distribution is still an issue for all of the reasons that Charlie mentioned. And so it was really getting to a case where unless you were distributing digitally or in print through Amazon, it was nigh impossible to get into libraries. But at the same time, not all libraries are able to purchase through Amazon. There are so many local, state, federal restrictions that prevent them from even purchasing books from independent publishers and creators, let alone the crowdfunding space. There are a lot of mixed feelings about purchasing crowdfunded comics, whether they're big IPs or, you know, independent unknown creators in the library space. So it's absolutely really hard right now. And I think I just agree with Charlie that just like in Hollywood, you're going to be seeing a lot more of what you already know. You're going to see the same IPs repeated again for a sequel or some other form of what we already have seen. And it's really unfortunate because I think that there have been and continue to be cries for more stories, for more diverse, mm-hmm. more equitable stories. And they're out there. They're absolutely out there. Yeah. But it just continues to be an uphill battle for X number of reasons of being able to get those stories out to people.
But Barbara, there's a new version of Batman that's even cooler than all of the previous versions of Batman. He's not rich. Is that what it is? I can't remember what the big changes these. Yeah. I confess I haven't read it. I'm out of touch.
Yeah, wasn't the new version? I was gonna say, wasn't the new version where he's a car, right?
No. That version. That's 4 years old already. All right.
The new version.
I'm pretty sure he's a construction worker or something with an axe, because Batman's about that.
Steals his costume from a drugstore. It's very interesting. Yeah. Let me throw this up there, and I've used this this analogy on the program before, but let me use it for the first time on our brand new YouTube channel. Welcome everyone. Comics and film right now are at this crossroads. They're at a similar place to where the music industry was when Napster came about, right? Just distribution models changing, and with the music business, the film study is a little bit more similar to music, like right on the dot. Where with music, it was okay. Well, for years, musicians they made all of their money selling records. Record companies made all of their money selling records. They toured only to sell more records and make money. But then Napster comes about, and suddenly overnight, people expect music to be free, right? Can't make money making records anymore, selling records, right? And so what do? There's panic, there's terror, there's what are we going to do? And then to their credit, the music industry very quickly inverts the model, right? And so now they essentially give away music. Music is free, right? We can go to 100 different places and play music for free. Sometimes we have to listen to an ad, but it's essentially free. And artists now cut records to sell concert tickets, right? To promote touring. They make all their money touring, selling merch, selling VIP experiences, all of these things. So they found this different way. They reinvented the business. Now you have the film industry. And we're at the same point where very quickly, because of COVID, everything moved on to streaming. And people are willing to whatever pay their $10 a month or whatever it is now. but they're not necessarily willing to go to the movie theater and spend $50. They're not going to spend another $29.99 on a DVD, on a Blu-ray, on all of these things. So all of the ways in which the movie business used to make money, they are no more. And so they are trying to figure out now how to make money off of the product. And they haven't figured it out yet. And so fewer things are getting made and there aren't as many jobs. And again, everybody's in a panic. And we are waiting for the film business to invert the model somehow or to take a hard left turn or whatever. And so I feel like the comic book business is sort of behind a little bit, but this is what's ahead for us. I mean, I think that we started this show 4 years ago, right? And we were talking then, and I think we had been talking for maybe 10 years before then about how the distribution model is out of date, you know? Any of us who made our first book, like, you know, oh yeah, I got this book. It's going to be in comic shops. Try telling your Aunt Cindy in Nebraska how to get a hold of that book. Right. It is like you have to draw her a fucking treasure map. Right. Or something like that. Really difficult. And way too difficult. And there are a number of other things that are wrong with it. And I think that we are just slowly but surely kind of seeing the wheels come off of all of it. And we are going to end up with something very different. And we are kind of holding on for dear life to the old formula. And for various reasons, we want the comic shops to stay, right? The comic shops are wonderful. They're these community centers. We don't want to see them die, but they're going to die unless we can kind of reinvent the distribution model. COVID put it all to the test. And so we're seeing this and I guess those are the bad things. And those are the things to be worried about. What we are seeing, and this is not without its difficulties also, is that, well, I mean, for the music business, this reinvention was amazing because it used to be that you had to go and there were five record companies. That was the only way anybody was going to hear your music. And they were all run by like 50-year-old white men, and you had to ask one of their permission to get your album made. And if they didn't give you permission, then your album didn't get made. And nobody heard it. You'd go play in some clubs maybe. And there's a success story or two, but very hard. And what we have seen is we've seen people like Charlie and Richard and Fanbase Press. They have, for the most part, operated outside, you know, this comic studio system, and they went and did it their own way. Right. They didn't have to ask permission to do anything. They did the books that they loved, that they cared about. And what we have seen, I think, even though there are things that are in questions, we've seen a strengthening of those inroads. I mean, like if we're a musician now, it exists that we can record an album in our garage on our laptop. We can dump it on YouTube or Spotify or Bandcamp or whatever, and we can make a little bit of money. I put comics in comic shops for a long while. Never made any money. I can sell 25,000 copies of something in a comic shop and not make a fraction of what I make if I get 300 backers on a Kickstarter campaign right now. And there's power in that. That is amazing. And I know it's a little more complicated than that. And I know that it's not quite as simple as it used to be. And part of the problem is that the getting was so good for a little while that everybody's like, oh, why do I want to mess with asking for permission? Let me just go to this place where Charlie and Barbara and Richard are having a great time, and let me set up camp. And then there's only so much pie to go around. Right. But I think that that's interesting. I think it's exciting. I think the future of this is what we're doing. Is taking it direct to consumer, is cutting out these middlemen. And then the bar is so much lower, right? I mean, we don't have to sell 25,000 copies of something to be a success. And it can be done over time. It doesn't all have to be done in a single month and then things getting canceled. We can build an audience over time and build a story over time and all these things. And to me, this stuff is so exciting. And so I want to get your reaction to that, to my perhaps misplaced optimism. How do you feel about that, Charlie? Because I think that kind of flies in the face of, were you going to go, Richard? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you.
I disagree.
You disagree with me?
Yeah.
With the optimism?
No, with part like parts of it all the way through.
Okay, all right. Prove me wrong.
We are in a year where there has been essentially one major superhero film. There have been a couple of other comic book films that have been massive flops, but the film industry this year, without Star Wars and without Marvel, has had more $1 billion box office returns than we've had since COVID. We are seeing movie theaters opening, not closing, for the first time. And what we are seeing is not people not making things. It's we're seeing like the aftermath of the strikes that is causing a lot of the upset. It's not really to do with that distribution model. What we're seeing is like the rubber band was pulled to a certain distance and then it snapped back, and people actually have said, I don't want to watch this fucking movie at home. I don't want to be looking at my phone. With music, like, yes, we went through a period where music was free. And like we do. We all expect music to be free. I steal Spotify from someone who doesn't know I have their password. It's great. But like music is also, we are now seeing albums being released physically more than they have been for years. CD and record sales are way up. And you're seeing artists re-release different cuts, essentially treating records like playlists now. I'll use Taylor Swift as the example because she's sort of at the same level as all of us. How many versions of Torture Poets Department have there been, which are just 7 or 8 of the tracks from the original with nothing changed, just a new physical release? And we're kind of seeing a lot of people do that. Yeah, the concert and the tours are to sell the records. They are to sell physical copies of the records at the merch table. You're seeing that far more. I mean, I go to a lot of concerts, and it used to be T-shirts, and now it's all vinyl.
Well, sure, but let me, because I want to get into the numbers. I see what you're saying, but the record sales now, even though they're up from, let's say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, they are a slim fraction of what they were in 1990. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And actually what you're saying, I think, kind of proves my point, where it's like the Taylor Swift albums, they are the $25 floppy is what they are. They are these sort of, they are these short edition collectible things where you're trying to collect all the variant covers, that sort of thing. They have become this, it is more memorabilia than it is like we're selling the music, we're selling the units. I mean, I would say it's like it is the merchandising I'm talking about, you know. And so while there might be an actual record in there, it is the equivalent of like the 90s comic boom when, like, well, we went to the comic shop and got Death of Superman and never opened the Mylar bag. This is a collectible. I don't want to take it out of the thing. Like I have my Pearl Jam records here that are the same way.
Sure. But we're also seeing record stores pop up in larger department stores far more. Like I know that you guys no longer have Toys R Us down here, but in Canada we still have Toys R Us, and now Toys R Us has a record store within it. There are chains of record stores opening in malls because people are, you know, like I don't particularly care about the finances of the music industry. My point is these things always snap back. I don't think people are going to be like, we're not like letting go of a distribution system. We're not clinging on to something from the past. It's about keeping our powder dry until these things balance themselves out and people go, actually, I do like holding a book.
Yeah, I'd like to square the circle a little bit between both of your opinions, which is, I think what's happening, what Richard is talking about with the record industry, and I think it's, you know, what's going to happen with streaming and television, is we're reinventing the past in a new way. Like, it's going back to the old model, but as you say, Ryland, the numbers aren't there. It's not going to be, no run is going to sell a vinyl album. No one's going to sell 1 million copies of a vinyl album. That will never happen again. There are not 1 million record players in the United States, probably. But
Creed sold 11 million copies of Human Clay. It's never going to happen again.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen again.
No, and that's
the world learned from that mistake.
No, and also that monoculture doesn't exist anymore. And the thing that's tricky about talking about these things with comics is that comics have dropped off way more than the record industry, way more than the film industry, to the point where our brick and mortar numbers are absurd, are a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche. And the question for comics is, that's never going to snap back to what it was either. but can the niche industry grow at all? And to what degree is anyone interested in growing it? I mean, I think, you know, the Alamo Drafthouse phenomenon is an interesting one where it's like, this is going to be more expensive than any movie theater you've ever been to before in your life, but you're getting a deluxe experience. You're getting good food. You're sitting in a comfortable couch. You're in something not much bigger than a private screening room. And that's what we can give you that's not sitting on your couch and getting it all delivered to you. And, you know, you're hearing rumor, you know, mumbles already. Eventually, all of the streaming services are going to offer a bundle of all of them together, and you've basically reinvented cable TV. Instead of spending $12.99 a month for Paramount and $9.99 a month for Disney and $12.99 a month for Max, they're going to say, how about you give us $70 a month and we'll give you these top 10 streaming services. And again, that's just a cable TV package done in a different way. But I don't know. To me, the only thing that saves the brick and mortar comics market is anyone having an interest in selling more comics to people, in selling kind of creating new consumers out of kids and et cetera.
I think the same desire is there, right? Again, this was an optimistic thing because I think this is good news for us because it gives us control. We have to sell a lot fewer units to earn what we need to make this reasonable. And it is, you know, it is about cutting out middlemen and machines. And I guess if there's a, you know, if there is a way to solve the film business crisis, because we see this all the time, right? It's like, well, you know, again, in the 70s, we had this amazing auteur movement, right? And then things kind of crater, in the 80s and in a very, you know, bubble.
But they crater in a way where the film companies are making more money than they've ever made in the history of film.
But from a, let's say, an artistic, like, sort of standpoint, they do it a little bit. But the answer to that ends up being the Sundance movement, which is one of the great film movements. Again, we're back to the auteurs. And it is always this thing that I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory as a director, and I went with people, at least a few people that were a lot more talented than I am. And there were a couple of Paul Thomas Andersons in there. And I think because of the circumstance of the film business, when they got spit out into the workforce or whatever, that they were never given their shot, at their Paul Thomas Andersonness. And I always thought it was tragic. And some of them are, you know, back in Pennsylvania selling insurance or whatever, when they should have been the great, you know, when this woman should have been the great one of the great filmmakers of her generation. And my worry now is that, in terms of generating money with blockbusters, like, okay, well, maybe we're starting to right the ship a little bit, but there are no jobs out there and there are no low budget, middle budget films being made. I have a TV show that has sat on the half yard line for a couple of years now because people are saying, oh, well, nobody's buying TV now. Like, TV's just done. Like, there are some things that are grandfathered in, and if you're Taylor Sheridan, then you're printing money. But as a market, as a community, this stuff is at a standstill now, and that is bad news. And so what I don't know what the film business version of Kickstarter is, what the film business version of you and I making a film in our backyards and taking it direct to market is. But I think whoever figures that out is going to be a hero.
I mean, I can tell you it's Kickstarter, but it's still impossible to make money on an independent film. I want to hear Barbara and Charlie's answer of, like, how are you adjusting what you're going to do moving forward based on these conditions that we're talking about? Barbara, why don't you chime in first?
Sure. So I do think that we're in a really challenging milestone moment for all media and honestly all industries at this point. I think it's a really big crisis because we are seeing consolidation, especially, and I'll just speak to like entertainment media, a consolidation of money, not just with bigger companies, but with at a level above that of like tech money. I think you're seeing tech money defining what happens moving forward. And so there is a loss at the very top of the care for the art and care for the, you know, the mediums themselves, which is really depressing and that's really hard. But I do think on the positive side of things, you are seeing in the comics medium a move towards things like crowdfunding, Kickstarter, et cetera, that allows creators to go directly to the consumers themselves. But unfortunately, I think it's very inspiring that always within the independent community, you see where new inroads are made. You see the ingenuity, the drive to build those new paths. But I think over time, as the folks at the top see those inroads being made, you see also new barriers being created along the way that make it more and more challenging. And even with the pure concept of supply and demand, as you see an industry grow and expand, like, you know, comics in the 90s, there's always going to be a bubble that bursts that just makes it deflate completely. And I fear that we're a bit there with a lot of entertainment media. So to your question, what are we doing in the path moving forward? For us at Fanbase Press, Brian's and I always joke that we're kind of like the Bailey Brothers building and loan of comics. We do it because we think there's an import to telling stories and to sharing our voices, because they matter. They matter to allow us to process challenging concepts and challenging experiences. They allow us to connect with one another, to bond, to empathize with people that we may not otherwise be able to do that with. And so for us, we will continue telling stories and promoting other stories, whether it financially benefits us or not. At the same time, we are mindful as we put more books out there, you know, we want to be mindful that we're not putting ourselves severely into debt doing so. But at the same time, we will absolutely continue to tell stories. We may not do as many as we previously did. However, the stories still demand to be put out there. And, you know, folks that don't otherwise have a platform or a voice to get out there, don't have the money, the access to the publicity to get their works out there, we are happy to provide that bullhorn to really shed light on them.
But you're still considering, like, possibly a lighter platform in the coming year.
Interesting.
Like that's
absolutely. You know? I mean, we've definitely even had recent conversations. We have a series in development right now, and we've had tough conversations about, hey, you know, we normally would love for a creator to be able to make, you know, if it's an issue to issue, as many pages you want per issue. But given tough conversations that we've already had with printers, even before tariffs are in place on what costs are going to look like next year, we've had to do some editing and say, you know, there's going to be a limit, a page count per issue, just so that we can make sure that we get the story out there. Mm-hmm. And that's not a fun conversation to have. But at the same time, we want the story out there. We want it to be in the way that the creator has envisioned it. If it needs to be a little shorter, so be it. But we still want that story out there.
Mm-hmm. And how does it affect your feeling about conventions and is your planning for conventions in 2025? Because that's in Ryland's metaphor, I think that conventions are the concerts. Conventions are the public appearance where you sell merch and you sell vinyl and you sell, you know, your product to people who aren't going in a comic store, but they're going to a convention, you know, they're finding you there.
That's a great question. And honestly, this year was our first year that we exhibited at the American Library Association annual conference. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic show. I loved it. Was it a huge moneymaker? No. Was it a money pit? 1,000% yes. However, we had such a great time that we had already signed up to exhibit next year. It was going to be in Philadelphia, which we're in Los Angeles. And we knew it was going to be a money pit. It was going to be the first ever show that we had to ship things to, that we had to get hotel, fly, et cetera. And after the election, we made the tough call to pull out of that show. We just could not risk, given the tumultuous nature of the library market right now, we didn't know what funding would look like for libraries next year to even get the small amount of sales that we did from the show. And we couldn't in good faith make that very large deposit of money, both for the show, for the flights, for the hotel, and everything extra that was required. Because folks may not know, but for the American Library Association, when you exhibit at a booth that's not the free artist alley table, you have to bring your own tables. You have to have carpeting for the booth. There are a lot of things that you have to do for an independent creator is not feasible. So we're absolutely, I mean, we always have a formula that we apply for conventions. And if a show doesn't meet that formula, unless it's extreme extenuating circumstances, we won't do it anymore. So unfortunately, that was a tough call we had to make for next year.
Extenuating circumstances is like being nominated for an award at New York City Comic Con, just off the top of my head, being a guest as one of the things that is an expensive con you went to because you were nominated for an award. Charlie, what's your perspective on that? How are you changing things going forward?
Well, I think, you know, like trying to draw a lot of this conversation together and just quickly touching on what you're saying with the film industry. I saw a really quick clip from Ben Affleck the other day, and I don't want to put him on the pedestal as the voice of reason. I also want to preface saying that I'm not necessarily agreeing with him, but he was talking a little bit about the use of AI going forward, not as a creative tool, but as a remixing tool that could be commoditized for the consumer. So, you know, like you've made Succession and the individual consumer wants to have a new episode of the series. And so they pay a fee because that content has been licensed to them and they're able to create their own episode of Succession. It's maybe not a good one, but it's a new one. It's the episode that they wanted to see. The point of that was it was creating a new product that was a personal product for someone out of the product that had already been there. And I think the thing about the DVDs, in the past, people had a lot of ownership over DVDs. It was their way of connecting with the medium and they would put them on their shelves. And, you know, I think with the film industry, whether it's, you know, that thing with the AI or something else, it's creating that experience, that concert version where you go and you connect with the artist, that I think the film industry has got to figure out. And that's going to probably be the next revenue stream that they're going to figure out. Bringing that back to comics, it comes down to, again, creating that connection, finding an experience. And I think that's what Kickstarter has been doing, in the sense that it connects fans with creators in a way that they don't necessarily have at a comic shop. At a comic shop, they're connected to the community and they meet other people there and the store is their connection. But the store brings in that content and unless the creator comes, they don't have a direct connection with the creator. And so like that's something that Kickstarter has provided. However, in this, you know, and you were touching on this earlier, while you could sell 10, 20, 30,000 copies in a comic book shop island and not make any money where you make something on Kickstarter with 300, there is an inherent scalability problem when you are a solo creator trying to, you know, put your stuff on Kickstarter, right? Like I have campaigns that range anywhere from 700 backers to almost 2,000 backers. And I'm very fortunate to have that. But on the flip side, fulfilling those things is very difficult. And so like that puts a cap on how much that can grow, how much revenue can be created there, even though I've created an experience that people really like, a product that people really like. And so you have to look at that as a creator and say, am I a creator or am I becoming a micro publisher? In which case you're going back to the old industry the way it was. And I think what you're seeing on Kickstarter right now, and this is the way a lot of people are kind of thriving going forward, and throughout Pat Shand, he's become a micro publisher. He has new titles coming out every month. And where I think that if he had less launches, he might make more money on an individual title because he could put more resources behind it, put more promotion behind it. As a whole, when you have a line that's coming out with new things every month, you're able to build a library, which means your library, your catalog is where you're making the money, which is how publishers traditionally have done it throughout generations. And that's really like some people ask, like, how do you continue to raise, you know, a lot of money on Kickstarter? And for me, that's part of it. It's that back catalog. And so, you know, for me going forward, I'm trying to lean into being more of a publisher on Kickstarter. So this year, I'm like, right now I have more launches, probably double the number of launches scheduled that I've had before.
How many are you doing?
9 or 10.
Is the plan. And how many different titles are you, is it?
So, let's see, there's at least 5 different titles.
Okay.
Because the plan right now, and we'll see still how it shakes out, is I'm going to be doing my first title that I'm publishing as a company that I am not the writer on, I am not the creator of, I am actually functioning as a publisher, but what I am bringing to it, besides helping with fulfillment and logistics, is bringing my brand to that book. You know, and that goes back to talking about brands combining together. And I think like that, you know, that's what I can offer to someone on Kickstarter is I have a larger brand. I have a fan base. I have a mailing list. I have people who come to me for books. And so that is appealing to some creators to do things under my umbrella. Now, for me as a company, I'm also looking to try to figure out how to diversify, because I think, you know, revenue streams from different places are going to become more and more important. So is there going to be a place where at some point maybe I'm an imprint at a publisher that does things in the direct market? Maybe that's something, a conversation I'm going to have towards the end of this year to try to figure out. Or am I going to try to get my own distribution deal? I don't think I'll do that at this point. But I'll be at Comics Pro. I'll be talking to retailers, which is in February. So for those of you who are here in LA, it's going to be in Pasadena. It might be worth going this year. And you can get I've been told you can get a professional ticket. I mean, you pay for it, but you get to go and talk to the retailers, talk to them about what kind of logistics work best for them. And I think that's the other hurdle is getting, if you're a Kickstarter creator, how do you get your books into comic shops? Because there is this stigma on them that they can't sell them, which I think, you know, that the audience has already been taken. And I actually think it's the opposite. I think if you're a retailer, you can look at Kickstarter and you can see books with a track record. You can see books that already have all the marketing materials up there for you in a way that, you know, most shops, I mean, don't get. You know, there's trailers, there's pitches, there's sample pages, and like it's all there for you. And you can look at proof of concept. You can see which series are growing, which have fans that come back to them. And the amount of people that are going to buy it on the Kickstarter that wouldn't buy it in your shop, it's negligible. So for me, I think that hopefully going forward, there can be some more back and forth between stores and Kickstarter.
Can I ask you, all right, so you're going to run 8 to 10 Kickstarters. How are you spacing them out? Are you going with shorter campaigns? I think this is good info. We have a lot of people who, you know, who watch us that are creators, would-be creators, crowdfunders, would-be crowdfunders, the whole nine yards. And I think that if you're running 4 campaigns in a year, it's easy to space them out 3 months apart and run 30-day campaigns. If you're running 8 to 10 campaigns, it's got to be different math on that, right? And so talk us through that a little bit, because I think this is good info for everybody.
Well, I mean, there's two things that I'm looking to do. Depending on the campaign, I'll have maybe a 3-week launch versus a 30-day launch. And I'm probably, this is all tentative. I just have to see how things play out. We'll be launching an official White Ash Comics imprint on Kickstarter in addition to the Charlie Stickney. So that way you can kind of finish with one and launch the other and go forward from there. But I think to do this, you have to have a certain kind of cachet with the backers because they know you're going to deliver. You want to have a certain amount of cash flow available. I mean, the next project I'm planning on launching will be done before it hits Kickstarter. So being able to do that. So I have a couple of projects coming out that will be at the head end of the year that will be finished before the campaign launches. And so the idea for me, you know, as a business person, is those things which are already done will pay back the cost that have been sunk in, but also bankroll things in the rest of the year. And hopefully going forward, and, you know, aside from Richard, there are artists that don't work quickly. And so it's a hard thing to do. I have one project that is taking over a year to get 48 pages done. And, you know, there's a variety of reasons for that. But I thought we had plenty of time. Look at that look on Richard's face. He just doesn't understand. But, you know, it's one of those
Richard
things.
Does that in the weekend.
Did the artist die after the first week? Is that what happened?
It feels like it sometimes. But, you know, I mean, like everyone has different paces. And so there are all kinds of things that you can't plan for. And so you have to take it one campaign at a time. But I do have a map for the year and where one thing starts, where one thing ends, where I'm going to be doing fulfillment, how we're going to promote one into the other, because like that's the other thing that logistically you have to think about.
Right.
How are you promoting the next campaign? How are you not losing people?
How are you going to fulfill 10, 700 plus backer campaigns? Are you bringing on a service? Are you pulling your kids out of school? Are you...
Well, like at the end of the day, if I have 10, 700 to 1500 backer campaigns, it's a wonderful problem to solve.
Sure. Yeah. Right? So you would think about finding a new fulfillment arrangement probably.
Yes. I mean, I would not be doing all of the fulfillment myself, whether that means hiring some people internally. I have a space now where I could bring people over to help me. In the sense that I didn't before. As you can see, this is not quite set up yet. We recently moved. And so the place I'm in now has more space. So we could set up a staging area. I could bring people in. So like there's lots of things logistically I'm still figuring out. But for me, part of that plan for Kickstarter is to operate as more of a traditional publisher. So it is like it's that going forward while also going back.
I want to ask you, I just want to tack on the addendum, and then I'm going to ask Richard about changes in plans for 2025. What about conventions? What's your take on conventions for 2025? Are you going to do fewer? Are you going to do more? Are you going to make a bigger splash? Like what have you learned from the past year, and how are you going to apply that going forward?
Well, honestly, I'm pulling back a little bit in terms of the size of the booth that I'm doing, because I lost a lot of money last year. But you know, it's branding. It's good to be there at some convention. So it depends on what your burn is and what the point of what you're doing is. But like I do feel like if you're in the same spot year after year, people eventually find you or realize that you're a thing. It's the seven touches, it's however you want it. And I've seen that work for me. But I also think that it really depends on the convention. And there's a shift where conventions are less about buying comics. I mean, and that shift's been happening for a long time. But even like post-pandemic, I've really seen a lot of people who are there, again, for the experience. And they're looking to show you that they're part of the community versus buy from the community. Right. And the number of people who are coming to look for some new IP they don't already know is very small. And so then you with the other independent artists are battling for that space.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's important to be in the same spot if you're doing a con year after year, because what I find is 60 to 70% of my con business are people who have come back to find me the next year. And then I try to get a couple of new people each time. So over time, that pool of people who comes to find me at the con grows.
So Richard, what about you? Kickstarter and, you know, and any other plans you have, but Kickstarter and conventions, you know, more, fewer, what's your plan for 2025?
I don't know. I mean, it's important that I don't do little baby numbers like Charlie, with the number of campaigns like that. That's just embarrassing. 8 to 10, come on, man. No. In seriousness, like a huge change to the Kickstarter landscape is that you now do not have to have a project approved to have it in pre-launch.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which means that you can now have. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who currently has 10 projects in pre-launch.
Wow.
And he's just like letting them sit there, not really telling anyone about them. You know, because pre-launches are now searchable, his numbers just keep slowly creeping up, and it's all just new people who are just discovering him by chance, so that when he does actually launch any of them, he will have an influx of people, which I think is smart and good.
Just to be clear, the numbers you're talking about is people clicking the follow button while it's still in pre-launch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because like that's an incredibly important part of like getting that day one audience to get that algorithm boost.
Yeah.
But it also, it just means that like it takes away that need for the 2 or 3 month gap between each campaign.
Right.
That everyone has kind of like clung onto for so long. I did 14 or 15 campaigns this year, depending if you count the one that I did the book for and sort of ran for someone else. But like next year, my husband is very insistent that I not die.
That's nice.
This is going to sound sort of morbid, but like, I think the riddle of my life is how much is it possible for me to do? And there's actually only one way to find out that answer. So I'm not particularly focused on doing less. My current plan is 16 campaigns next year. But also, you know, I plan to do 10 this year, and I only ended up doing 4 of the 10 that I planned, and then another 11 on top of that for different things that just came up.
And obviously these aren't 30-day campaigns. You're now doing 15-day, 10-day.
There are a handful where I just decided to see, can I run a Kickstarter while I'm at a convention, as what I call bonus money. And so I had 2 4-day campaigns that would launch on a Friday and end on a Monday, while I was out of town. But mostly they've been 21-day campaigns. I never go above 28.
How did the 4-day campaigns go?
Oh, they were fine. They were just for like, it was, you know, I made $1,000 to print a book that I was already very much finished. This is the wonderful thing is I don't pay my artist because he's a piece of shit who doesn't deserve it.
Right.
For anyone who doesn't know, I am the artist. It's okay. Please don't get angry at me. Someone got so mad at me recently because I said I don't pay my artist and I didn't vote. I'm not American. I'm allowed to not vote. I did 35 conventions this year, and that sort of felt like too much. I'm confirmed for 17 next year so far. And I think I might kind of cap it at about 20, because otherwise I don't have time to actually make the books anymore, you know?
Right. Right. Have you ever done, you said 4, 21, and 28. Have you ever done between a 4-day and a 28? Have you done a 7 or a 14 or whatever the...
Yeah, I like a 17-day campaign because it means you can start on a Tuesday and end on a Friday. Okay. And so you get that like
there's a nice lot little,
you get the 3 Tuesdays in a row when everyone's on Kickstarter, and then you get that nice little end of the week thing where you can kind of push people on a Friday when they're just making their like bad decisions at the end of the week.
Now I'm curious about that because there's the mythology we all are familiar with. Certainly everyone on this call is familiar with of how, I mean, I've done a handful of campaigns. They've all been 30-day campaigns, and in every single one of them, a third of the money has come in the first 2 days, a third of the money has come in the last 2 days, and that other third just kind of drips painfully in over a period of 27 days. And I've always wondered, if you remove that middle 27 days or cut it down to 5 days or 7 days or 10 days, does it appreciably change the amount of money you make?
Well, and it's interesting because it got more and more compacted to the beginning in the past year for a lot of people. It seems to be like you get half your money day one, you get a quarter of your money day two, and you get a little bit of a boost. People are all talking that they're not getting that final day boost like they used to. They're still getting a bit, but nowhere near what they used to get. And I think that's I don't know what the maybe people are tired. Maybe people aren't doing their like, hey, come on, let's get in here at the last second promotion. I certainly see less of it. We're seeing far fewer let's rescue this campaign things going on online. And obviously with the complete implosion of comics Twitter, things are much harder to promote. Like Blue Sky is great for engagement, but it's sort of like Instagram in the way that it doesn't really drive sales.
I wonder about that because I think that's more of a growing pain thing than something that's built into Blue Sky. I think the comics I've been very impressed with how quickly comics and I noticed this as an animation writer. The comics and animation communities are incredibly robust on Blue Sky. Mm-hmm. And I noticed 2 months ago, which made it very, very easy to sort of close down my Twitter. It's still there, but it's locked. And I look at it maybe once a week. But I, you know, I think this is worth repeating for the kids at home who haven't heard me said it. I did the same post on Blue Sky and Twitter when I was active on both of them. I had 12,000 followers on Twitter and 2,000 on Blue Sky. On Blue Sky, it got 500 likes and like literally a quarter of my followers liked it, and 50 retweets and, you know, handful of all very positive responses. Mm-hmm. On Twitter, with 6 times the following, I got 5 likes and 1 retweet. And that just told me that the algorithm is absolutely uninterested in sharing anything with my followers on there.
No, you're absolutely right. But yeah, like,
you're going to translating that into sales is a whole other engagement issue. But it's a start. You know,
it's also that like you're going to see a massive shift away from that. Like, I'm not ever going to argue that Twitter is good, but when you're seeing that 500 of your followers liked your post on Blue Sky, it's because if I look at my Blue Sky feed, I follow a couple of hundred people, but it's not an algorithm. It is chronological. Yeah. And it means like I can often see that the top post is 17 minutes old when I refresh the app. People are having, you know, your 2,000 followers have a much higher chance of seeing you than they probably do by now. You know, we're going to see a drop off. Since, everyone there.
Also worth noting, since the election results, I now have 8,000 followers. Like, mm-hmm. it literally jumped by a factor of 4, you know, 4 times yeah. the number. And a lot of that is the starter pack thing, which is a very smart, it's the smarter version of what on Twitter 10 years ago was called Follow Friday, where mm-hmm. someone creates a list of like, here's 100 comics people you should follow. And a lot of, you know, particularly fans, but also pros, but particularly fans will go, oh, I'm going to follow these 100 people. And I can always kind of tell, like, I'll look at my new followers and go, okay, 200 followers just suddenly appeared at 2 a.m. Like, where did this all come in? And I just scroll back and find the starter pack I got added to. Excuse me, which is, again, it's a helpful thing. We'll see the degree to which it turns into a community that buys comics. Mm-hmm. But I think ultimately, you know, the base problem of all of this to me is still that the readership of comics is a joke and a rounding error compared to every other mass medium. And I don't know that that changes a lot without the big two doing something about it. Like, I don't know that indie creators make that change.
No, and that's why I think that when Charlie says you have to be the same place at a convention year after year, it's the same philosophy everywhere. Like, the people who survive in indie comics are the ones who just don't go away.
Yep.
I mean, I think it's that thing where we all look at the generation above us and we go, how do these people have this much money? It's just because if you're there for long enough, you kind of get some more. Mm-hmm. Like, things just build up. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're in the same spot at the convention, I mean, I do a thing now where if I'm doing a convention for a second or third time, I just prepackage like 10 bags of this is everything that's come out since the last thing. And I just have them under the table because I know there's going to be people who come up and say, I want everything you've done since last year. And I can hand mm-hmm. them 15 books.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that taking that point and bringing it back to Kickstarter, because I do think that there is something that's worth saying for people who are listening to the podcast, who are new, who are thinking about launching a Kickstarter campaign. When you look at those 4-day campaigns or 15-day campaigns or 30-day campaigns, you have to remember that this is also your spot at the convention. And so it is 30 days of exposure. Mm-hmm. And you know that if it's your first time out, you might want to have that longer window, even if it's only your second or third time out, because you want the marketplace to get to know you. And then on the flip side, I think one of the reasons why some people have found the end of the campaign dipping is because they're on Kickstarter all the time, you know, and there used to be an urgency. If I don't get this issue of something, you know, of the breach, I won't know when Ryland's going to be back on Kickstarter. I won't know when I can get the next one. I don't know where I can pick this up.
That's a really great point, Charlie.
But if you have a company that's launching every single month, it's easy to kind of like, if you're not a first or second day adapter, I'll just wait till next month and I'll pick it up as an add-on. So
that's such an interesting observation, Charlie, because that's basically, we have people who do a campaign every month, you basically create the Kickstarter version of trade waiting.
Yeah, I mean,
like, well, I could buy the first issue of this thing, but Charlie's going to sell me the fourth issue of it with issues 1, 2, 3 in 4 months. So why don't I just wait 4 months and buy the trade or the White Ash catch up pack that's going to have all of the issues that I didn't support.
and this is why, like, so much of my approach has had to be finding ways to get people to feel like they have to get things in the campaign when it's the first time around. And to kind of like, I had to be very strategic with like which things are actually available as add-ons. One of the things is, you know, I won't put something up as an add-on until the campaign that it was part of has been fulfilled, because I do not want new people being able to buy it. I don't do the late pledge thing because I don't really like it. It seems like a way of softening that market. But like, I'm not saying I'm hugely successful with this or anything, but like one thing I'm doing is with any of my bigger campaigns for books that I want to really push, I will put out there's a free book, and I put out, you know, an extra book with it for the first 50 physical backers. And it's just an 8-page mini comic, and I'm not going to have that available to anyone any other way. And people can see from the campaign that this is a run, you know, it's book whatever out of a 64 book run. And if you want to have all 64 of these little mini comics to put together on your shelf or put into a nice box, then you have to get my books on day one or two, basically. And it's being a micro publisher and having to mimic the thing that a larger publisher would do to a far lesser degree of success, but it's kind of the only way.
Right. No, that makes sense. And, you know, and again, we're always playing scarcity games. We're always, you know, that partly that's baked into who the consumers are. And that's baked into, I think, the Kickstarter idea is like, it has to be special. It can't be just, here's the book. Hope you like the book. Mm-hmm. And I look, just, you know, for a little interesting perspective, Jeff Smith is currently doing his first Kickstarter for a deluxe edition of his Great Bone comic. 1,200 backers, 11 days to go, $242,000 pledged of a $50,000 goal.
Good for him.
And there's the part of me, and this is the tricky, I think, not to pour cold water on the Kickstarter thing, but the part that's painful to me is we don't get into this for 1,100 people to read our comic.
Mm.
We want more than that. We want a bigger, and it's great to make money, you know, but sometimes you do go to the direct market so that you can sell 30,000 copies, even if you don't make a dime for it, because that's 29,000 customers. New customers who might actually find you on Kickstarter. Maybe they might not. They might find you at a convention. Maybe they might not. But, you know, there's a part where it's pretty, you put all this time and energy in, and it's great that they reward you. You know, the first Drawing Blood one was $105,000, and it was 1,200 people. And it's great, but I do like that the Image comic that I'm not making a dime from is being seen by more people.
That is part
of the goal of what any artist does.
It's good for the career too, because it's like my first Kickstarter was 15 grand instead of 3 to 5 grand because I put comic books in comic shops. Like there's no arguing that. It was like I went on a Kickstarter and it was news. You know, it was like, oh, we know this guy. This guy did this and this. Right. And that follows you around. It fuels everything else. So it's like Yeah, I mean, you're not just doing it for dollars, more than anything. I mean, all that said, it's like, well, it's great to have 25,000 people read it or whatever, but also, like, you know, I write for an audience of one, you know, and if I like it, then great. And, you know, when the Army veteran, you know, comes up to me at a convention and talks about the book that I wrote, you know, 8 years ago and says that it meant a lot to him, like, that's everything. Like, I don't, if I just have him, like, I'm happy, you know? So yeah. It's like,
we are all trying to, you know, build something out, and that's, you know, we're doing it a variety of ways. And yeah, the one-on-one interaction with a reader is great, but it's, you know, you do try to think of ways, okay, how can I get this in more hands, you know? And Kickstarter is part of that formula, and conventions are part of that formula, and we're all sort of trying to balance the three things, you know, the three avenues together. And, you know, it has become a more challenging space to promote anything, and we're all, you know, again, like when I did my first Kickstarter, Twitter was a huge source of customers, probably the biggest source between me and my other contributors, my other collaborators. Now that's gone. That's blown up. And so we're all out here looking for the new ways, you know, and that's part of what we, you know, we all wanted to get together and talk about today. And, you know, again, it's,
can I ask, you
know, no, go ahead.
I was going to ask Barbara a quick question. Sure. Do you find that you have your fan base press mailing list? How important is that to you? Because I think that's what we're getting at here.
It's a great question.
Your own audience. Yeah. Like, and I feel like you seem to cultivate that really well.
Well, that's very kind. Honestly, we struggled for the longest time. I've collected emails for the better part of 15 years. But it was always this thing that, even though folks would tell us constantly, and I think Charlie, you were one of the ones, a proponent of please do a newsletter. It was something that was really easy for me to put on the back burner because it just seemed like so much work and yet another, you know, thing to diversify what we were already doing. But honestly, I'm flabbergasted by the positive response that we have received every single week from the newsletters. And I'm always, I start, for those who are not subscribed, I start with just a personal, very brief message to everybody. And I struggle to really, you know, because I realize that we have a wide swath of subscribers from all different facets of the comics community, librarians, retailers, et cetera. And I wanted it to be very professional. I wanted it to be something, something perhaps that I was not. And so I just ended up leaning into being myself and providing a message from the heart. And I feel like that's what has connected most with people. Sure. We always add a discount code in there. Not one person has utilized it. And yet, that's honestly, great. I'm shocked by every single week, because I think we're on the 13th or 14th week at this point, I'm shocked by the continuously increasing open rate, by the continuously increasing click rate from the links within the newsletter. And it's all stuff that we are promoting already. I mean, the interviews we do, the press releases we put out, reviews, podcasts, et cetera. But we're doing our best to just provide resources again to do exactly what we've always set out to do, to be the bullhorn, you know, to promote ourselves, to promote other people. And I feel like it's just another way to lean into that. And yet I feel like, to Charlie's earlier point, it is only further solidifying our brand and who we are, mm-hmm. and, you know, putting that reminder in folks' inboxes every week. And even if you don't do anything with it, even if you just open it and read the opening message, that's fine. It's there for you every week, and it's there to be what you need every week.
Are you using MailChimp? Are you using Substack? What is your...
We're using MailChimp. Okay. And we really debated between MailChimp and Constant Contact and Substack. But I was a little worried because I know that there is some pushback that folks have. I like Substack. I'm subscribed to a lot of folks on Substack. I know that some folks have pushback to it. And I also feel like I've seen so many things like Substack come and go, and I didn't want to necessarily get on there and then a few years down the line have to change again. Charlie, I think you gave us the great advice that, you know, MailChimp works, so, you know, go for it. And I'm really happy with it so far. It's enabled us to do exactly what we need to do. So we're there.
We and should Richard, Richard, are you on MailChimp? I can't remember which one you use.
I used to be on another one. I can't remember what it was called, and then they changed their name to Brevo or Brevi or something, and I was so horrified by that rebrand that I switched to MailChimp. I just didn't like the mouthfeel of the word. I hate MailChimp, I'll be honest. I hate it. I hate it so much. I hate how it loads slowly. It pushes a lot of AI shit at you every time you open it, and it's pretty inconsistent with its like pricing structures, and in the time that I've been on it, it's massively jacked up the price for different things at sort of seemingly random points. I started a newsletter 3 years ago, and I was really dedicated to putting out a newsletter every single week, and that lasted for 9 weeks, and then I like it's the constant battle of being the everything, and I think we all know what this is like. Is it? It's one more thing that can get swept away, and you always writing a newsletter seems like it should take 15 minutes, and without fail, it always takes 2 hours.
Yeah,
and suddenly you're like, well, I can fit it in right now. I have 15 minutes until I have to be at my next thing, and then you absolutely don't. But what to echo what Barbara was saying, there are a lot of people out there doing newsletters that are, here's what I'm doing right now. Here's the exciting thing. And usually some kind of, here's what I'm reading, here's what I'm watching bullshit that sort of is meant to humanize you. And it without fail comes across as like hollow. You have to just put in like, here's how I'm feeling. Here's who I actually am as a person. And well, I think I probably took that too far.
But I want to, you know. But the thing I want to wrap this up because Barbara has to go in a minute. But the first thing I learned about the internet and making money on the internet and having a fan base on the internet is probably something that was known by the studio executives in the 1930s and the people making fan magazines. It's all about parasocial relationships, and that's who you sell to. You sell to the people who think they're your buddy, even though you've never met them and they just have read your newsletter. And Barbara, Richard, Charlie, you all have personas that appeal to the people who buy your stuff. And that is, in the final analysis, that's it. That's, you live or die on that. And Richard, you're right. I have seen those newsletters from people that are just like stunningly insincere, where it's just like, it's what they think everybody is talking about right now. It's what they think people want to hear. And honestly, there's probably a TMI aspect out there for some people, but Richard, I don't think your readers are people who are going to be offended by TMI.
Yeah. I had an incredibly low, incredibly high open rate and an incredibly low unsubscribe rate. I think I had 4 people unsubscribe in the entire time I was, and I think I've probably put out 30 newsletters altogether. And, you know, I talk a lot about bot stuff and vomit at different points and other cool shit that has happened to me. And, you know, often in the days leading up to it. And the worst response I ever got was I put out a newsletter with the title of it was signing divorce papers at a sex club. And it's what I did. It was telling a story from the end of my first marriage. And my father, who subscribed to my newsletter without me knowing, didn't read it, just read the subject line and called my husband in a panic to find out what was going on with us. Right. And my husband was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I've like, cause the firm rule in our marriage, don't read my fucking newsletter, honey.
Right. That makes sense. Well, we want to be mindful of everyone's time. To wrap up for now, Barbara, I know you have to leave us for another call, but tell us where people can find you on the web and what you got coming up next.
Absolutely. You can always find Fanbase Press at fanbasepress.com. We're on all of the social medias. We're becoming very active on Blue Sky. So you can always find us there. And I'm on all of the social medias as well, generally at Barbara J. Dillon. But it was just really good to talk to all of you because I adore every single one of you. So thank you for inviting me.
Barbara. Thanks for joining us. And you can race off if you need to.
Will do. All right. Talk to you soon.
Be good.
Bye.
Charlie, where can the folks at home find you?
I finally actually have my name on Blue Sky, so you can get me under Charlie Stickney versus Charles Stickney on some of the other things. There's also White Ash Comics Instagram, but those are the best places. Coming up next in late January, probably, maybe early February, depending on how things shake out, I have a Glaren and Thane one-shot, which is going to be a little bit of a Romancing the Stone action rom-com, detailing how White Ash's first couples first got together.
Nice. And Richard, what's next for you?
This is dropping what, early January? Whenever.
Maybe before then, but yeah.
I'm either in pre-launch or it is live, my campaign for a new 100-page horror illustrated horror story called Crooked Little Town. After that is a memoir graphic novel called Richard Fairgrace Sold Me This T-Shirt. And I think after that is issue 2 of Wet Cement, issue 1 of Lights That Guide You Home, my new series, Butt Stuff, and then some Blastosaurus.
Nice. And
Richard Fairgrace. If you find a Richard Fairgrace, it's me. I'm the only one in the whole world. Helpful. It's very easy. I think I'm going to start, now that Charlie has his own name on a social media, I'm going to start picking up the other ones. So you can find me on Blue Sky as Chuck Stickney, Chucky Sticks, Big Charlie Stickney Boy.
The real Charlie Stickney.
The real Charlie Stickney
official.
Really good.
I feel like those are all good names, but they don't have the right mouth feel. To quote someone else.
Can I just, as an aside, say really that mouthfeel is a movie that is a word that fills me with what's the expression? Incoate rage. The word is texture. The word you're looking for, Anthony Bourdain or whoever the hell started this nonsense, is texture. That's all. That's just, we already had a perfectly cromulent word for texture. And you had to come up with some nonsense.
And now Avalonia's dropping cromulent.
I don't want to talk about the texture of a word, though. And I think the feeling that your mouth makes when it says brevo is so disgusting.
It's not great. Ryland, where can the kids find you, and what do you got coming up?
You can find me at cromulent.com. I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. If you're just listening, I hope you're not, because we are on our new YouTube channel now that you need to subscribe to. Smash that, smash the like button on the video, smash the subscribe button on the YouTube channel, and tune in for more Madcap fun next week. Richard sold me a couple of t-shirts. We are currently embroiled in a lawsuit over the name Butt Stuff. Because I named something Butt Stuff like 3-4 years ago. Now he's trying to name his thing Butt Stuff.
And you can try and get a book out before me if you like, Ryland, but no one else can ever manage it.
you'll have it out tonight
mine is BUT, stuff.
Oh, okay, interesting. All right, yeah, okay. Well, yeah, then maybe we're okay.
Where did your mind go, you pervert?
Mine's the other butt stuff. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh no, mine's about anal sex. I should be
okay. Really clear mine's about Herman Butts, who played tight end for the San Francisco 49ers in the 70s.
Mine has tight ends at the beginning of the story, but by the end of it, there's no tight ends.
Yeah, we are stepping on each other. Maybe what we need is some synergy, like Charlie was talking about. We'll team up and we'll do this together.
Charlie, does White Ash Productions want to pick up butt stuff?
A lot of tight ends in there.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to see how that mouthfeel comes together.
Yeah, there it is. Off the rails. First day on YouTube, we already have a content strike. I guarantee it. As far as that, what I have going on, again, State of Consciousness, Haunted Heart, on streamers everywhere. Go check those out. In Comics Land, like Charlie, I too am becoming a publisher guy. So you will see probably 6 Kickstarters from me this coming year. I'm not quite up to the speed that Charlie is just yet, but I'm pouring it on to the best of my ability. And you will see the 4th issue of The Jump, which is technically an election special, you know, which should properly infuriate you know, both sides of the country, which is right where I like to land. You'll see that in late January, early February, probably right next to Charlie's book. So get on and back both of them, and also back the 5 books that Richard kickstarts while we're doing those. But you'll see new issues of the Peacekeepers, which people are really excited about. You might see a new issue of the Breach. Half Evil Comics, my company, is moving into branded comics. We have a hold of some really interesting properties, and you will probably start to see those start to drop over the course of next year. It's going to be an exciting time. We're going to bring you a lot of great stuff, stuff you're going to want to read, stuff you're going to be excited about. And yeah, so tune in. Bring us.
Oh, I just remember what you told me. That's yeah. People should be excited about that. People should pay attention to Ryland next year.
There you go.
Nice.
Yeah. We're keeping it under our hat, though.
Yeah. I've got new episodes of Batwheels just dropped on Max, and they'll probably be on Netflix at some point. In the comics world, as I said at the beginning, top of the show, issues 7 through 12 will wrap up Drawing Blood sometime in 2025, and we'll see what happens there. We got some Ragdolls one shots that will be coming around those times, and the newest latest from Dynamite is I have a Savage Tales coming in the early part of the year, probably January, and then I don't know, 5-6 months from now, the first issue of Two-Fisted Fairy Tales, a cross between Saving Private Ryan and The Princess Bride, which that should interest you. Thanks for joining us, Charlie, Richard, and Barbara. And we'll see you, hopefully see you, on the next exciting episode.
Thank you, YouTube. If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.